Hey guys, check it out. Here's how to help support the show. First of all, sign up for the RSS feeds, iTunes, Stitcher, and all that stuff at scotthorton.org. And then also drop by scotthorton.org/donate. Anybody who donates $20 or more, you get to go to the front of the list to get the audiobook of Fool's Errand first when it comes out here real soon. Any donation of $50 or more, you get a signed copy of the paperback of Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. For $100, get a QR code, silver commodity disc, which tells you its instant spot price in real time. It's really great. And anyone who donates $200 or more to the Scott Horton Show gets a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think audiobooks. Listen and Think libertarian audiobooks, that is, at listenandthink.com. And hey, did I ever mention I take Bitcoin? Hint, hint, all you brilliant libertarian Bitcoin zillionaires out there who bought a bunch in 2009 like I should have. I take Bitcoin. It's all at scotthorton.org/donate. And big thanks to all the monthly subscribers who donate the 10, 20, 30, whichever dollars a month there. Really appreciate those a lot. And hey guys, stop by patreon.com/scotthortonshow. Anybody who signs up to donate a dollar or more per interview there will get 2 free audiobooks from Listen and Think Audio. All that is at scotthorton.org/donate. Also shop amazon.com via the link at scotthorton.org. Give me a good review on iTunes or Stitcher, you know, if you like the show. And if you read the book and you like that, then review it at Amazon too, if you would. Oh yeah, and you know what? I give speeches too. Why don't you hire me to give a speech to your group? We'll talk about the book. I'll sell some. It'll be great.
Sorry I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
Well, we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, bitch, say it 3 times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing the great Eric Margolese, our good friend. My good friend and yours, the author of American Raj, Liberation or Domination, and before that, War at the Top of the World, both of which are just incredible books. You got to read them. And he writes regularly at uns.com, at lewrockwell.com, and I'm not sure where else, a few other places. Anyway, welcome back to the show. How you doing?
Thank you, Scott. Always happy to be back with you.
Good. Hey, one of the things that I like about you is you know all about North Korea. And also you say smart stuff about it instead of all the crazy lunatic things that a lot of all the pundits and opinion makers in America seem to believe in. Like, yeah, boy, we better do something horrible about that situation. But so I was thinking maybe I could ask you if you could sort of lay out the situation and the most important facets of it the best that you understand and maybe recommend a way we could ratchet these tensions down and have peace instead of a gigantic Holocaust.
Will do, Scott. I've got the answers for you.
Thank you.
We stand now a rifle shot away from war against North Korea. President Trump and his men have blundered us into a corner with North Korea, with all their huffing and puffing and blowing the house down and violent threats, almost as bad as Hillary Clinton's threat to utterly destroy Iran. Now we're talking about utterly destroying North Korea in biblical terms. We are very close. Today, as we speak, there are 340 or 350 U.S. warplanes and warplanes from South Korea just probing the borders and the sea borders as well of North Korea, including heavy bombers, stealth aircraft, you name it, it's there. Plus, we have a very powerful naval armada, and more units have been flown in to bolster the 28,500 U.S. troops of the 1st Division, I think it is, that are south of the DMZ. So we're all prepped up for war. There's all this war talk coming out of Washington. Munitions and supplies are being rushed to Korea. We're ready to go if it happens.
Oh, man.
Look, we've set the stage for war. We, the Trump administration, has set the stage for war. The South Korean government, which is ostensibly independent, has said no. We have to ask their permission before we go to war. The Japanese are just cowering and ducking down, hoping nothing bad happens. And the other players in this area, we Americans tend to forget that North Korea is like 100 kilometers from Vladivostok, Russia, and about the same distance from Shenyang, China. Two major cities of Russia and China. And if there's any war, they're going to get the blowback from it.
Oh, man. Well, so, but here's the thing, though, is you can't have a war in Korea because millions would die and it would be a disaster. And there's no way you could get all their nukes in the first afternoon before they were able to use one of them or something. And so reasons upon reasons upon reasons why this ceasefire must hold, Margulies. So why should I be worried that something's changed now? No way.
Because you have an irresponsible president who is in a very unpresidential fashion here, who is being given bad advice by the yes men around him. And he's talked himself into this situation and doesn't know how to back out. Nobody wants a nuclear war, not even Trump. And if there's a war, it'll devastate Japan, which is the third largest economy on Earth and will cause an international trade recession. And Trump might be happy seeing the Japanese get blown up, but it's very serious. And also there's an ecological disaster in the works. So everything is bad. And it's the scariest we've been in since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's all due to Trump's braggadocio.
Yeah, so in other words, it's really not like Iraq War II, where Bush says, you know, a year and a half beforehand, look, we're doing this, and I'm going to scare the hell out of you between now and then until you let me, kind of thing. It's not that. It's just that, you know, more like O.J. Simpson and the Naked Gun, just stepping in a bucket and hitting his head on the door jamb and all these things. He's actually in danger of blundering us into a nuclear war.
That's right. Trump keeps threatening, you know, fire and fury and, you know, either give up, play, cry uncle, or else we're going to turn North Korea into a sea of fire. All this kind of baloney he's been giving. And he has to do something. You know, Kim Jong-un in North Korea has been mooning him from a distance. And to show how foolish Trump is, he's firing off these rockets, which are increasingly efficient and may have nuclear warheads. And Trump doesn't know what else to do. The whole North Korean nuclear infrastructure is deeply buried in the mountains. It's unlikely that it can be knocked out by airstrikes. Even the Pentagon admits this. So the only way to dig them out is by using tactical nuclear weapons. And that's a course that's terrifying.
Man, well, okay, so I know this guy is, he's a lot of different layers of fool, okay? We're talking about Donald Trump here. But, you know, it seems like, at least in one frame of reference, it's possible that he's playing up all this madman stuff on one angle, but then he's got Rex Tillerson to play good cop and say, hey, maybe we can have some talks. But then when Tillerson talks, Trump directly undermines him and publicly undermines him. And more and more they're leaking out that Tillerson is going to be fired in order to undermine any North Korean confidence in anything he might promise them at all. And so, you know, I don't expect for Trump to actually be a good artist at the deal, but I do expect him to understand what a deal is, you know, and how if you're going to play bad cop, you have to still give your opponent an out. Or what, you know what I mean? Simple stuff.
Yes. Well, there's no earthly reason why North Korea should back down and agree to end its nuclear program. The Washington has made that a prerequisite of opening negotiations. It's like they're going to have to agree to denuclearize, as they say. Let Washington denuclearize for a change. Let both sides get rid of their nuclear weapons. That would be a good start. Otherwise, Kim's, it's a tired truism now, but Kim Jong-un saw what happened to Gaddafi and what happened to Saddam Hussein. And these were people who gave some trust to Washington, and they ended up dead. And the nuclear weapons are the only thing that protects them from an American attack. Why give them up?
Yeah, well, and the thing is, though, I mean, they have been willing to give them up in the past. And, you know, there's this recent statement, I forget exactly which North Korean minister stated this, but he said that, you know, we will never negotiate our possession of nuclear weapons as long as the Americans continue their threats, which to me sounded like a really big opening. And maybe they wouldn't give them all up. But then again, even as recently as 2008, George Bush was working on a new and pretty good deal to get them to go ahead and call up. This was after they'd exploded at least one nuke, maybe two. And they were, and maybe the only two they'd ever made. And they were willing to deal then. So it just seems like, man, we had a great deal under Clinton that Bush Jr. ruined, but then Bush Jr. pretty much could have had a good deal, but then he blew it. And even now they're leaving loopholes open in their statements about how maybe they would deal someday if we would back off about 6 degrees or so, which to me is obviously fair. So I wonder if you really think it's that bad. I mean, I guess assuming the bad faith of America from here on forward, yeah, it is, right? They'll never give up their nukes in the face of this empire. Just maybe if I was the president, but that's different.
I wouldn't if I was Kim Jong-Margulies either, because it keeps them alive. But also it's bought respect for North Korea. You know, the South Koreans must say, this is very interesting. America is quaking in its boots because of North Korea. Meanwhile, South Korea is just bleeding little things about, oh, please, let's have peace and things. Who's the real Korean power here? Well, it's Kim, and not President Moon of South Korea. But, you know, back when the period in the past that you were referring to, the North Koreans didn't have any long-range delivery systems. So the best they could possibly, the worst they could possibly do is try and loft a bomb over to Japan or attack the U.S. troops in South Korea. Now it appears their missiles do have the capability of reaching all of North America. I don't know how they got these missiles. I just wrote that about that. Somebody, I believe, has given them a really important engine technology. They have a very powerful... Well, you remember when we in the U.S. were developing missiles, that used to blow up and fall over, and it was very embarrassing. This hasn't happened to the North Koreans very much. So they're on to something, and now they have the capability of striking the U.S. and Japan. Nobody cares about South Korea, but Japan is really important. And let's remember, in range of Kim's medium-range missiles are close to 100,000 Americans.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they say now that they've proven they can reach Washington, D.C., so that certainly changes the ballgame. You know what, though? And I know we've talked about this before, but it still seems so obvious to me that the Americans have so much power compared to the North Koreans that we're in, and never mind just Trump, but I mean America and the empire in general, that they're in a really good position to just say, you know what, bygones, bygones, let's go ahead and have a peace treaty. Let's go ahead and do, I don't know, at least a half-assed version of Nixon Goes to China. Why not? What really is so unreasonable about the American position or the North Korean position that this just can't happen, Eric?
Well, what's unreasonable about the American position is that 50, 60, 7 years after the Korean War, we still have troops garrisoned in South Korea and Japan, and naval forces and air forces. In fact, these bases are the centerpiece of our whole Asian geostrategic power. And there's no reason why they should be there. South Korea has a 600,000-man armed forces, very well equipped, very tough. I've been with them in the field and under the DMZ. They can defend Saudi, but the problem is, did you know, Scott, the amazing fact that in the event of war, the South Korean army comes under the command of a four-star American general. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. We don't have that anywhere else in the world. So it really, it shows the vassal status of South Korea. If the U.S. were to lessen the pressure there and cut down on the nuclear confrontation, people, the first question people would ask, why does America need troops in Japan and South Korea? Why do they have to be in Guam? What are they doing? Who are they defending against?
The whole thing's just a racket, isn't it?
Well, it's nobody wants to change the status quo. And the United States is happy with this. It likes it. It makes us claim that U.S. forces there are keeping the Asians from each other's throats. There may be a grain of truth to that, but by and large, we're not there out of altruism. We're there to promote our own strategic interests. And so people are going to say, why keep all these troops there? There's no good answer to that. America is an imperial power, and it sees that its Pacific imperium is being challenged by China and, to a lesser degree, Russia, and it's panicking now. So it would rather dig in deeper than make concessions and thin out its presence in North Asia.
Yeah. Man, I'll tell you, I forgot if we talked about this, Eric, but I know I brought it up on the show a couple of times, but there was a piece in the LA Times, and it was by a Hoover Institution, Stanford, so the right, you know, Heritage Foundation type think tankers. And the point was, yeah, but you know, if we made peace with North Korea, then we wouldn't have North Korea to hang over the head of Japan and South Korea to threaten them with this danger that we're protecting them from. And without that, well, they might spin away and be independent from the American Empire, or even worse, fall into China's orbit.
Actually,
it was that blatant that that's why we have to. And this was right at the height of Trump saying fire and fury like the world has never seen, when America's used nukes in battle before, or in war before, you know. And right at the heart of that, he's saying, yeah, but it's worth it. You know, at the threat of nuclear war, it's worth it, because otherwise, what if Japan stopped doing what they were told?
Well, our power is not so much in aircraft carriers as in granting access to the great American markets. And for South Korea, for Japan, for China, Vietnam, Thailand, all these countries, I mean, their wealth is being built at Walmart. And that is part of the American power structure. And it still works. Rome used to do this back when granting access to its market. So but the military is, the odds are turning against the United States for sure. The other thing is that a united Korea is a very interesting situation. Not many countries want it. They prefer Korea weak and divided. 50 million Koreans in the south, 25 million in the north. This would make Japan very nervous, because right, the Koreans and Japanese hate each other, as you know. And
especially if you combine the South Korean economy with the North Korean's nukes, you have real power.
That's right, and military capabilities. So there's an easy way out of this. It's for the U.S. to declare an end to the Korean War. You know, we're still at war with North Korea. It's crazy. Since 1953, where there's been an armistice, but not a peace treaty. I've been in Panmunjom. I shot a film there, in fact, where the so-called peace village where they met, and this silly armed standoff still going on. The second thing is to relax the economic. We've been waging economic warfare against North Korea, and we've got to open up trade, allow them to import goods. And instead of many spending money on arms, they'll be spending it on, I don't know, Nintendos and Budweiser beer you name it. The other thing is that the U.S. has got to assure North Korea that it won't attack. It's ye old non-aggression treaty. It's all possible. It all can be done. We've done it with many other countries. And then send Trump to Pyongyang to shoot a round of golf with Kim Jong-un and compare missiles and bury the hatchet. Life will go on and nobody will care. You ask one in 100 Americans probably knows where North Korea is and what the capital is. It's not a burning issue except for the imperial faction in Washington.
Man. Yeah, and they clearly prefer it this way too. I mean, they act as though. There was a quote from McMaster this week. Yeah, geez, we're in such a rock and hard place position where this seems to be leading to only one conclusion. It's, man, he's the one setting all the false premises about how this thing has to go, you know, acting like it's just the forces of nature acting upon him or something like that. It's crazy. And we're talking about, again, a war that almost certainly, if it starts, it'll be nuclear, right?
Geopolitics is too important to be left to the generals. Particularly to the generals around Trump, who are capable soldiers, I'm sure, but they're not grand strategists and shouldn't be there. Yes, if the war comes out, it will almost certainly involve nuclear weapons to some degree. The U.S. has long planned to use tactical nuclear weapons if North Korea attacks South Korea and rolled south. And this is also a possibility, can't be discounted. But the effort to destroy North Korea's nuclear weapons will have to be done by nuclear weapons, a surprise strike that could come as early as tomorrow, this evening.
Man. All right, well, so Trump said, well, we'll get the Chinese to handle it. And the Chinese, they told him no, or they tried and it didn't work, or what?
Well, this is a shallow thinking proposal by some of the people around Trump. Anybody who knows North Asia knows that the Chinese wouldn't go along with a deal to dismantle North Korea and turn it into an American colony. The North Korea is useful for China because it protects its northern flank. It distracts the hell out of the Americans and the Japanese, and is an ally of China. So China is under no great pressure to do anything. And I don't see any way the U.S. can convince China to invade North Korea, overthrow its government, and set up some sort of new government.
All right, hold on just one second again here. Hey, guys, check out the show notes for all these podcast entries at libertarianinstitute.org and at scotthorton.org. Damon's doing a great job on all the show notes on these things. You guys were asking for them for a long time. Well, now you got them. All right. Buy my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Buy Mike Swanson's book, The War State. It's an early history of the military-industrial complex after World War II. And take his investment advice at wallstreetwindow.com. Buy your precious metals from Roberts and Roberts Brokerage, Inc. That's rrbi.co. And get your anti-government propaganda from libertystickers.com. You want a brand new 2018 model website? Go to expanddesigns.com/Scott and you'll save $500. Hey, can I ask you about Yemen?
Sure.
So did you see the news this morning of Saleh's dead body in the back of a pickup truck there?
Yes. That's how a lot of Middle Eastern dictators end up.
Yeah, he looks just like Gaddafi.
Yes, I was thinking the same thing too, Scott. I never met him, but I spent time in Yemen, going way back to 1975. And it's a wild and crazy place, filled with wild and crazy tribesmen. It's like Afghanistan. And you just don't know what's going on there, and they're very odd. I follow Middle Eastern affairs closely, as you know, but I couldn't explain to you what the Houthis who are fighting the Saudis are all about in depth, but the Saudis are trying a scorched earth policy in Yemen and trying to starve the people into submission. And we, the United States, are hand in glove with the Saudis in the starvation and bombing campaign. It's disgusting.
Yeah, so I wonder, with him dead, and apparently what happened was he was trying to tilt back toward the Saudis and backstab the Houthis, and they got the better of him. which I guess was unexpected, depending on who you ask. But so, I guess nobody really knows or is in any real position to predict whether the army factions are going to go ahead and stick with the Houthis, the guys that were Saleh's buddies, whether they're going to stick with the Houthis or whether they are going to go ahead and go along with Saleh's plan to make peace and rejoin with Saudi power there. But
he was a notoriously tricky guy, and he had backstabbed some of his allies in the past. It's a very a nasty piece of work. So's the other little pretender president who's in Aden, who's a Saudi puppet.
They have him on house arrest in Riyadh. He's not even allowed to go back to try to become president, I guess, because he'd just get killed too easy.
Well, it's a very murky situation, and it's all part of the ongoing power struggle inside Saudi Arabia. And the Emiratis are involved, you know, the Abu Dhabi and Dubai people, trying to press their own agenda to be big shots. It's very murky. I can't tell you what's going to happen. Usually I can, Scott, but on this I can't.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny, I guess. I don't know what could have been, but it seems like maybe his, you know, he could have actually brought some kind of ceasefire if he could have made the Saudis settle for him. He just couldn't make the Houthis settle for him, too, even though they've been allies as of recently. I don't know how he screwed that up, but it seems like that was some kind of chance for a ceasefire and now blown.
God, it's very murky. Back in the was it the 60s, 1970, the Egyptian army was in Yemen trying to support the Republicans there who were fighting the royalists who held the capital. And the royalists were completely surrounded and cut off. No, it was the other way around. The Republicans were completely cut off and surrounded. And the Republicans said, surrender or die. And the next day they collapsed. And the Republicans won. So it's very hard to tell what's happening. It's a very closed society made up of warring tribes and regions. Very hard to read.
Well, so what do you make of all the accusations that America and Saudi are just trying to contain the expanding Persian Empire?
Oh, that's total monumental BS. The Iranians are only lightly involved in Yemen, very lightly. They have no history of being involved there. They're completely different religious groups, don't like each other. And you know, maybe they're supporting the enemy of my enemy is my friend, but it's not big time. But the Saudis, who are notorious liars, keep saying they're fighting Iranian aggression, and too many Americans believe this nonsense. It's not true. This is a local conflict having to do with local people, rather like Afghanistan.
Yeah. Hey, you know, speaking of which, I saw a thing in the New York Times that I was surprised to see in the New York Times. Not that I was surprised to see anyone express this sentiment, but in the Times, and it said, oh, yeah, you know what? The safe haven myth, you can forget about that. There's no real reason to think that even if the Taliban did take over the country, that they would let al-Qaeda come back. Al-Qaeda hadn't been there in years, and the Taliban would have no interest in provoking another war against them for a second time for the same stupid reason. And so, don't worry about it. I wonder if this guy read my book, but I like his article.
Great minds think alike, Scott.
Yeah, so what do you think of that? I know you have, above all, you know, you're in the very highest percentile of Americans who have experience in Afghanistan there. What do you think about that? I mean, maybe that's not even stupid, and that actually, no, you would have international Arab terrorists plotting to go to Arizona flight schools and attack American towers.
Oh, it's just part of the old scare campaign, the boogeyman going to come and get you, the Arab boogeyman. We have a steady stream of Middle Eastern boogeymen all the way back to the days of Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt, Mossadegh in Iran, and so on and so forth to the present. Those are our central casting boogeymen. And there is no doubt in my mind that Afghanistan would become a center for terrorism and all this kind of hysteria. Al-Qaeda was barely existent in Afghanistan when the U.S. attacked in 2003. All those terrorist training camps that we were told about were actually, most of them were run by the Pakistani Intelligence Service, an ally of the U.S., and they were training guerrillas to go and fight in Indian-held Kashmir.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the ones that they use for the attack here, those training camps were in Florida, right at the local flight school.
And some of the 9/11 plot was plotted in Spain and in Hamburg.
Right.
What the hell do you need for a plot like this? You need a room, and that's it.
All right. Well, as long as we're talking about Afghanistan, you know, the Taliban have said for years that they just will not negotiate as long as the Americans are there. And yet, at the same time, they've got to be sick of fighting by now, too, at least some of them. And I wonder whether maybe they would come to a deal before, you know, any of Mattis's fantasy of some new victory over them could either pass or fail. But just maybe they could decide to cut a deal where, say, they promise not to march on Kabul, but just to keep sort of the predominantly Pashtun areas in the south and the east, and you leave us alone and we'll leave you alone. Or it seems like a deal like that might be able to be worked out. No,
Scott, it's a reasonable thought that you have. I wonder, they've been fighting since 1989 or something like that. 79, I'm sorry. And it's just endless war and terrible destruction. Huge amount of casualties. The U.S. government has always concealed the amount of people killed in Afghanistan. Some sources put it up to 1 million. Some say in the hundreds of thousands. But it's substantial in this dirt poor country. So yeah, there must be a temptation to do a regional deal of some sort, or a partition of the country to stop the bombing. And the bombing is increased now by a third, if you can imagine that. Heavy bombers against tribesmen with Lee Enfield rifles. It's really sickening. But if there is a deal, the deal may be overturned. So Afghans are very prickly and unreliable, and they change their minds. So they're difficult customers.
Yeah, well, now they're saying, I mean, we've seen this exact thing before. It's, you know, year 16 of this war we're talking. They're saying, well, what we're going to do, see, is we're going to abolish heroin traffic in Afghanistan. The biggest cash crop, the biggest single part of their entire economy, most of which benefits the Taliban. Although the American side, you know, also are drug dealers. But it just seems like this is their plan, right? This is exactly what they said in 2011, in 2010 and 2011. See, what we're going to do is we're going to make it where there's no more heroin, and then that way the Taliban will be broke, and then they'll start doing what we tell them.
Brilliant, brilliant. Some young officer hasn't read the files, came up with this great idea. He's going to be the next General Petraeus, Imperial General, and come and defeat them. Now, this is nonsense, because the entire Afghan drug trade at the highest level is controlled by allies of the government, our boys in Kabul. Nothing moves in Afghanistan without approval of the government. Trucks, main roads. Yes, Taliban are involved in the sense that a lot of poor Afghan farmers grow poppy. It's the only thing they can sell, the only cash crop. But it's not Taliban that's buying that drug trade. In fact, when Taliban was in power, it completely eliminated 98 to 99% of the opium trade. When we came and overthrew the Taliban government, our allies in the north, which you know, Scott, the Northern Alliance, started up the drug trade again and are still running it.
So you think that really, I mean, well, but Helmand Province is under the control of the Taliban, and that's where most of it's grown out of the whole country, right?
There are other places, too, though I was traveling through there, and I remember seeing all these red flowers as far as the eye could see, and me, a New Yorker, naive to the ways of the countryside, saying, oh, what are these beautiful flowers? And I said to me, opium.
Well, but I mean, the Taliban drug wars, it seems like if they had one back then, still as a growing insurgency since 2005, they need its revenue, its taxation, and the money from trafficking in it, right?
It's like telling people in Iowa not to grow corn or wheat.
Yeah.
So well, that's what. And
there have been plenty of American warlords on the record, including the former president's half-brother and a whole list of them who are, you know, proven drug dealers, admitted by, you know, David Petraeus, his buddy Abdul Razak, down there in Kandahar, where Petraeus is like, yeah, he's a heroin dealer, but still we like him, or, you know, or they don't even deny it, basically.
Well, that's the old from the 1950s. He's an SOB, but he's our SOB. Speaking of the Somozas.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, was that the Batistas or the Somozas? I forget.
I think it was old man Somoza.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah. All right, well, listen, man, I sure love talking to you and reading the things that you write.
Well, top of the season to you, Scott, and I look forward to more chats.
No, I really appreciate you coming on the show, man. Have a good weekend and holiday and all that stuff.
Bye-bye.
All right, take care. All right, you guys, that's the great Eric Margolies. He's at UNZ.com, U-N-Z, UNZ.com. No one man should be able to trigger nuclear war is one. And brand new, Washington runs amok while Kim smiles. Those are both at UNZ, and we'll be running this one tomorrow on antiwar.com. And so, yeah, that's me, scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, libertarianinstitute.com, and Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. That's my book. It's at foolserrand.com. Buy my book, Fool's Errand. It's at foolserrand.us and at amazon.com. I know I just said that, but that's why I said it twice, was so that you would listen the second time. Okay, thank you very much. Goodbye.